This podcast series is brought to you by Hyundai. Hyundai is building a better world for tomorrow by aiming to neutralize CO2 emissions at all stages of production and operation. Hyundai is working toward carbon neutrality by 2045. Learn more at HyundaiUSA.com.
Up until this point, we've focused in on the very real ways the auto industry has evolved on its impact on the global climate. We've looked at the history, automakers' unique decision-making on electrified products, how suppliers are transforming their manufacturing processes, how government can help or hurt efforts, and the technology that could accelerate these changes. This has mostly been a story of hope, of progress, and of zeal. But this story would be incomplete without acknowledging the substantial and very real obstacles in the road ahead. And even if the industry continues down this path without hitting major roadblocks, will it be enough? This is Driving to Zero, the auto industry's roadmap to carbon neutrality. I'm Jake Neer with Automotive News. Parimal Arumugam leads the mitigation division for the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, or the UNFCCC.
Some people, they say UNFCCC. sometimes people use four Cs, which we do not know which is the fourth C. So often now we call, like, when people speak, they normally say UN Climate Change Secretariat.
Could be cool, or it could be...
the cool climate secretariat.
Yeah. There you go. Parimal says the UNFCCC essentially acts as the chief accountability office for the Paris Climate Agreement. He says we're entering a critical period for climate action, and the news so far isn't good.
The science is quite clear. Like, we have been listening alarming bells from IPCC, etc. We are still off the track.
He says some of the big reasons include a lack of finance globally for climate-saving projects and methods, trade-offs and synergies between development and climate, and last but not least in his mind, effective pricing on carbon.
Once you have to pay a price for what you are emitting, you start looking at opportunities to reduce. So it brings the culture of identifying an opportunity to reduce within a given sector. That paves way for technological innovation.
Regardless of the prescription, he says the transportation sector is a massive part of the diagnosis.
In 2021, the global CO2 emissions from the transportation sector is like around 7.7 gigatons, which is like huge in terms of, like, it's 4.5 to 5% of the total global emissions.
Now, a significant amount of those emissions are coming from the shipping and aviation industries. But Parimal says the auto industry still has a very important role to play. In fact, he says it's uniquely positioned to set an example to the rest of the world about how different sectors can work together to make the massive changes needed to save our climate.
I think automotive industry is one area which will be a right blend between a producer and a consumer. And then if you have international financing community and the investment community putting billions and billions and dollars towards technological changes to look at transformative and paradigm shift within the transportation sector, this can offer a template.
For example, remember earlier in the series when we talked about the changing relationship between automakers and electric utilities in the shift to electric vehicles? Parimal says this is another unique opportunity to show how business leaders can help transform adjacent industries.
Okay, you can produce EV vehicles, but then you need to have storage, you need to have charging stations. So how the system works may also be a template which can work for an energy sector, for example, in its supply chain and the value chain.
But let's look at that switch to EVs. Parimal says it's an example of another big challenge, the inherently slow speed at which these kinds of solutions move.
The number of vehicles that are on the road today, the stock of the vehicles, is 15 times more than the annual new car sales that are happening globally.
Vehicles are very long life products. The average age of vehicles on the road in the U.S. today is over 12 years. And so even if we stop building internal combustion vehicles today, you'd be looking at decades to replace the 290 million registered vehicles that are on the road today.
That's Sam Abu-El-Samad, a principal research analyst leading Guidehouse Insights' e-mobility division. Guidehouse is a global consulting firm. Sam's team, in part, helps clients develop their strategies on a broad range of areas where companies are trying to decarbonize. I spoke with him and his colleague, Mike Austin, a senior research analyst at Guidehouse. Mike echoes those worries about decarbonizing vehicles on the road, even under the best case scenario.
So even if nationwide we're above 30% of new EV sales by 2030, it's still less than 10% of the vehicle population. So we have all this effort and all this energy, and it takes a long time to set up those pieces in the supply chain to get to EV volume. And even with all that effort and even with all these increasing sales, it's still, you know, a fraction of the cars on the road.
And Sam and Mike say there's also plenty of things standing in the way of that best case scenario for EV adoption. Sam says one of the biggest barriers might just be the consumer.
The problem is consumers are not rational. Consumers buy for their worst case scenario, which is why you see so many people driving around in full-size SUVs and pickup trucks that really don't need them. But they buy what they think they might want or need at on some hypothetical day. But most of the time, they don't need it.
And Mike says one of the best solutions is one that automakers and customers alike probably won't accept.
On a societal level, if we want to decarbonize transportation, the biggest thing you can do is not drive. Mm-hmm. And which kind of runs contrary to what the automakers are doing, which is trying to sell cars.
Right.
But also, again, you have an irrational consumer where, you know, you could say you could live in a one-car household, or you could use a bike, or you could take public transit. Some of that we don't have set up. There's a lot of car dependency in the U.S. all over. So there is a lot of the question of how do we reduce our overall carbon emissions falls on things that the automakers can't handle.
But Sam and Mike say there are so many reasons not to throw in the towel on decarbonizing our roadways. In the last episode, we talked about the promise of technologies, including solid-state batteries. Sam thinks those faster charging batteries and better charging infrastructure could make EV ownership appealing to a lot more Americans.
As charging gets better, becomes more available and more reliable. That's the key, is the reliability and also faster. You know, if you've got a 150-mile EV that can recharge in 10 or 15 minutes, that solves a lot of the problem. And if you know that you're going to be able to pull into that charging station, plug it in, and it's going to work, that addresses most of the problem.
Above and beyond the product, they're also optimistic about broader decarbonizing efforts as long as automakers keep ramping those up, which is still a question.
Maybe it's a little cynical, but these automakers have made good pledges about decarbonization, but they're not quite saying we're doing everything we can right now before they get there.
But Mike says auto companies are slowly but surely realizing the real economic benefits of cutting carbon in their industrial practices beyond just the marketing benefit of attention-grabbing headlines.
Carbon neutrality is cool and fashionable now. A lot of corporations, not just automakers, like to tout it. Some of it is playing a little fuzzy with the rules, like, you know, a carbon sequestration or you know, carbon credits from forests, and there's not necessarily great accounting with that, or there's cases where that's being abused. And I don't really expect that most corporations are going to say, you know, no, listen, we're not doing any carbon credits. We are like 100% carbon free. All of our electricity is renewable. There's a lot of reasons why they wouldn't do it. But as an optimist, I would also say the things that are coming along are going to help that. Even if a corporation didn't want to be carbon neutral, if you look at things like the advancements in solar and wind and how the cost of generation has dropped over time, as we're electrifying transportation, as renewables become more usable and more integrated into the grid, all of these things are just going to make a stronger business case, not just a marketing case, for that decreased carbonization. So I'm hoping for the best.
And he says perhaps the most likely thing to propel the industry towards zero emissions is the thing we don't even know about yet.
We can't predict where a lot of this is going to go. It's super early, and there's a bunch of things that you won't anticipate 10 years from now might be a big deal. I mean, everyone points to the iPhone as the example, but you know, when the iPhone came out, you wouldn't have expected that it would be able to warn you of health risks because of, you know, something it detected in your watch. similarly, we're not going to, you know, we don't know that about electrification and batteries and the changing transportation landscape, but it's all interconnected. So, you know, the more that you can put those pieces together and maybe make guesses at what's going to fit together or what's going to be that catalyst to make a bunch of change, that's where you're going to find the clearest picture in your crystal ball.
When we come back, we'll look at what we've learned along the way while exploring the auto industry's energy transition, and we'll keep talking about some of the biggest challenges ahead and whether the industry is truly serious about these efforts. That's next on Driving to Zero.
Hyundai's vision, Progress for Humanity, is based on a determination to ensure universal mobility while supporting a carbon-neutral society, with plans to electrify the entire vehicle lineup and over 20 years of research into hydrogen technology. Hyundai is leading the way for change toward a more sustainable world. Hydrogen, in particular, is a crucial component of Hyundai's carbon neutrality efforts, and it's more than just an alternative fuel source for passenger vehicles. From production, storage, and distribution to hydrogen use in trucks, public transportation, ships, urban air mobility, and beyond, Hyundai is invested in establishing hydrogen as a widely used energy across our entire society. Hyundai is committed to building a better world for tomorrow, and the future of hydrogen has never been more promising. Learn more at HyundaiUSA.com.
Hi, I'm Pete Bigelow, host of Shift, a podcast about mobility from Automotive News. Each week, I bring you a conversation with leaders who are on the cutting edge of transportation, like this one with consultant and strategist Salika Josiah Talbot.
The technologists are forcing themselves in a space that they shouldn't be. And I think the social scientists and politicians are falling down on the job.
To hear more about the new technology and policy reshaping the way people and goods move around, join me on Shift. New episodes each Sunday on autonews.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Well, we are coming to the close of our limited series here on how the industry is moving to cut carbon. And just to sort of close things out, again, we have Automotive News Executive Editor Jamie Butters with us. Jamie, thanks once again for joining us.
Glad to do it, Jake.
And Hannah Lutz, Automotive News Electrification Reporter, who's been covering so many of these topics for us. Hannah, welcome back to Driving to Zero.
Hi, Jake. Thanks for having me.
So I think we should talk about a lot of the positive things that are happening in this space and also maybe some of the biggest challenges ahead. Let's start with the positive. As we've sort of uncovered through our reporting and through this series as well, you know, the investments in electrification are really substantial. I don't think you can argue against that at this point. But I'm curious, in your minds, both of you, how significant they've been. And Hannah, let's start with you.
Yeah, so we've seen investments really from all sides, which, I mean, it's hard to really add them all together. But when you look at charging infrastructure, when you look at manufacturing, battery development, battery recycling, there's been so much investment just in the past few years. Even earlier this year, $100 million for repairing and maintaining chargers. If anyone was wondering if this is really going to happen, if we're really going to electrify our fleet, this proves that it will. We don't know exactly when all of the vehicles on the road will be electric, but this investment is really making it happen.
Yeah, Jamie, I think one of the conversations we had near the outset of this is this perception of greenwashing. You know, many industries have sort of been accused of this attitude that we're going to put out press releases and say we're going green when the actions don't really back that up. But in this case, as Hannah said, you know, we're talking hundreds of billions of dollars. I mean, you can't really argue that's not real.
No, it's very significant investments. As, you know, Mary Barra is fond of saying, we're going to see more change in the next 10 years than we've seen in the past 100 years. That's all true. Of course, you know, what we've really focused on with this series is the actual carbon output. It's carbon, as to borrow the phrase from Toyota, carbon is the enemy. It's not necessarily gasoline. It's not cars. So it's a much more complicated thing, but electric vehicles are an important component of that, probably the biggest part of the automotive picture. But it's also, it's the energy industry, it's how the vehicles are made. There's a lot that goes into it.
I mean, just kind of going off of what you both said, it's fair to say the genie's out of the bottle here, right? I mean, people have talked about what if there's political change in the future, all that sort of thing. But I mean, it seems to me, at least, correct me if I'm wrong, it just doesn't seem like the industry, at least it doesn't look like there's any going back at this point, both when it comes to the embrace of EVs and also sort of the investments in cleaning up their entire sort of process. Is that fair to say?
I think that change at the political level could slow down the acceleration of EVs. I mean, I think that the intentions of the automakers are clear, but if some of that pressure was removed, then the transition could slow down a bit. But I mean, they've made their product plans and they've made their investments, so that will all stay true. I think the development, at least for now, is really, really fast, but that doesn't mean adoption is fast. That will take time.
One troubling element of the political picture is that a lot of people, a lot of Republicans, have come to see EVs as a luxury of the liberal elite. And they politicized it and turned, you know, driving an EV into a political statement, which it can be. Obviously, if people are driving an EV, or you think back to when the Prius was first a hit, people were trying to make a statement about being, you know, environmentally aware. But sometimes it's just a cool car. And people should be allowed to do that without it having to have political baggage. And of course, we're just so early in the development of the technology to really make the superior economic offer, that'll happen over time.
Well, speaking of the politics of this and going into policy, you know, the government incentives for zero emissions vehicle adoption and the infrastructure involved is also something we've talked about during this series that seems like it is certainly ramping up in a big way. Jamie, what are your thoughts on sort of moving forward, looking down the road? You know, the government's role seems to be sort of solidifying and established in this sort of transition.
Yeah, the Inflation Reduction Act has been with us long enough. It kind of feels normalized. There's some things we don't entirely know. How's the foreign entity of concern rule going to be worked out? But it is still kind of amazing when you step back and think about $7,500 toward each electric vehicle potentially, and the idea that that is targeted to reach 50% or two-thirds of the market by 2030, 2032. We could be talking about 12 million vehicles getting $7,500 worth of, you know, federal incentives a piece. Of course, there's the income limits on it, but if people go to leases, then all the vehicles can qualify. So it could be very costly. It could be a huge bill for the federal government. If 8 million vehicles get $7,500 of federal tax support, that is a $60 billion a year subsidy from the federal government to the auto industry. And then, of course, we hit a cliff after 2032, when presumably the vehicles will be capable of standing on their own, but that's going to be very disruptive as well. So it'll be very interesting how it plays out, but certainly, yes, the government is right there at the cash register with the American consumer when they're trying to buy their EVs.
Yeah, the government also has taken a big role in deciding where these EVs are going to be built and where their parts will come from and where the materials for the batteries will come from. So localizing the supply chain has become a big push toward that because of these federal incentives.
So let's talk a little bit also about one of the things that surprised me a little bit, and at least in the way that it's framed, and that is the role of the investments that we're talking about outside of the immediate auto industry in some ways. You know, when we spoke with DTE Energy, the utility here in Southeast Michigan, it became pretty clear that there are programs in place that would essentially allow the industry to pump money into just the greening of the grid writ large, not just for their plants, but, you know, that they're playing a bigger role in, you know, being able to say, hey, we're offsetting whatever energy we're using at our plants and you know, producing renewable energy through that. But really what that means is that, you know, the electrons that we bring into our houses and our cars and, you know, businesses, more of them are coming from green sources because of some of the investments that the industry is making. Jamie, you know, I know we talked about this in a previous episode, but it seems like that plus the investments that the industry is making in technology, this has a lot of tentacles that reach outside of the immediate auto industry and sort of make everything cleaner.
Yeah, there's a lot of potential benefits that can sort of snowball over time, that can build on each other. Part of it is, as we know, I mean, these technologies are still, they're maybe not in their infancy, but they're maybe in their adolescence. Solar cells keep getting more powerful. I think the wind turbines, the progress keeps making in their efficiency, and of course how the energy gets stored from those. The automakers stepping up and installing these, you know, solar fields or whatever else they're doing to jumpstart the greening of the grid. Once they get done, which, you know, this is a years long process, but once those get built, by then, the next fields that get built will be even more economical. So when suppliers or regular consumers are saying, hey, I want the solar energy as well, they'll be able to get a higher return on their dollars in the future.
Let's talk about some of the biggest challenges now. In terms of EV infrastructure and adoption, Hannah, I mean, we talk about this a lot, but how far do we still have to go at this point to build out the infrastructure specifically, and what's lacking?
So there's a lot of building definitely that needs to be done. There needs to be installation of the chargers, both level two, which is a slower charge kind of when you're out and about and need to just top off, and the fast chargers that can get you a charge in, you know, 30 minutes or so. So you need to install those, but then also you need to make sure they work. So that's been a very significant challenge in the industry, the reliability of the chargers. Just an anecdote, over the weekend I was in Toronto and there were like probably 20 level two and fast chargers in this parking structure that I was in. Every single one of them was out of service. It must have been like a full like system outage or something. They must have all been connected, but they were all out of service. So
wow,
it's a really big issue here and in Canada, apparently. And it's something that the industry is trying to address really fast, because it needs to be addressed very, very quickly if the adoption of EV is going to scale.
So what kind of manpower are we talking about when it comes to just maintaining and working on, you know, all of the infrastructure that's needed for electrification?
So QMerit, which installs EV chargers and does some training, they think that the U.S. will need at least 142,000 more certified electricians by 2030, and that's to support the country's full electrification push. So that's EV charging, solar panels, battery storage, smart panels, et cetera. So yeah, we're looking at over 100,000 more people to do that. The skill set required to fix these chargers is something that we haven't really seen combined before. So first, many of these charging requests, you need to be an electrician. You need that sort of expertise. For other issues, you need to have a software background. So there's this like combination of skill sets that you need, and maybe one person has them all, but maybe not. So it's really trying to put together this whole sort of new industry of people to work with these chargers.
And Jamie, we talked about this a little bit in the last episode too, but it is one of those things where it's not only a practical issue, but it's also a perception issue, right? In terms of convincing people to buy electric vehicles in the first place.
You know, it is such a huge change of mindset for the consumer, right? From the way most of us grew up, I grew up in the 20th century, you know, you had a car, you filled it up at the gas station. There's one on every corner, it seems like. You never are very far from being able to refill. And so now you've got a new technology. You don't necessarily have the confidence about how much range it has, depending on the weather, depending on how you drive, and just an unfamiliarity with that. And then when you throw in the complication that charging the batteries, which is sort of refueling, can take a long time. You don't know where to find it. You don't know if it's going to work. It's just a lot of anxiety for consumers to overcome, especially with a product that typically costs, you know, 10% or more than the old-fashioned technology that they're used to.
It is just a complete lifestyle change. Like if you are driving, you know, the vehicles we're used to, a gas-powered vehicle, you don't have to think before you get in the car. Even if you're out of gas, you know you're going to find a gas station with gas like within 10 minutes. So you don't have to do much thinking. When you drive an EV, you have to plan out your whole route and just hope that the charger is working and hope that there's not a line so you can get to your destination on time. And then also consider the weather. Is it freezing cold outside? Is my range going to be less than it was advertised to be?
Right. And in terms of that, convincing people to buy these vehicles and also to, as you said, change their lifestyle in some way, you know, we're seeing just recently, really, this unexpected slowdown in EV growth. Now, that doesn't mean that EV sales, you know, in general are down. It's just that they're not growing quite as fast as some people had hoped for. And that has some people nervous. I'm curious what you both think. Is this a long-term concern or do you think it's a short-term blip that we're going to get past?
It feels to me much more like a blip. I think it's possible if you're a policymaker, if you're an investor, even if you're somebody in one of the companies, you might have a little crisis of confidence that Americans aren't ready, that the market isn't ready. And certainly, if these cars that are on the road today are all that we were ever going to have, we would not be getting to 50% or 40% EV adoption. But we know there are a lot more and better cars that are coming. We know that the charging networks are getting built out. So I think this is just part of a long curve, but it's a bit of a gut check after a couple years of really robust growth, 50, 70, 80, 100% growth, to now be looking at just kind of ticking along at, you know, 7% market share, maybe 8%, that path to 10, and then when we're starting to really get into the mass market, it's the tough slog right now.
And it was just under 8%, I believe, was the market share. So it's still pretty small, but I mean, it shows that we've already gotten through the early adopters. It's big enough that we've gotten through the early adopters. So now the industry is trying to market and sell to buyers that were not jumping on the wagon right away. Like there's more selling to be done now, which takes a lot of effort from multiple groups, from the automakers, from the dealers, et cetera. So that is one thing I think that maybe is slowing the growth. There's a new effort involved. Also, you know, there's been a lot of talk about affordable EVs, but we aren't really seeing any yet. So once there are more affordable EVs out there that people can buy, maybe we'll see some upward growth.
We already talked about infrastructure and charging, and maybe that's the answer, but I'm curious what you both think are the biggest consumer hangups on EVs that are the most concerning for that longer term adoption. Jamie, do you have one or two that you think are going to be the biggest hurdles?
I mean, price, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's the vehicle and the charging. And so then how we break it down, I mean, it's the price, but it's also the right fit, you know, the vehicle that's big enough for a given family, you know, and doesn't maybe add a bunch of extra cost by having, you know, range that you don't need. But then the second thing that is right there with it, right? Whether you consider it range anxiety, or I think a lot of us now call it more charger anxiety or charging anxiety, that concern that we've been discussing about, can I get where I need to go in the timely manner and get home safely? You know, those are the big hangups. It's the price and the charging availability.
I mean, price, I think, is number one. Most buyers are monthly payment buyers. They look at what their payment's going to be, and that helps them decide. But I think, you know, to put it in one word or a couple words, it's really confidence. Like, you need to be confident in going out on the road. And if you have charger anxiety, you don't know if you'll find one or if it will work for you. And you don't know if you have time to charge, because at the fast chargers, it's 30 minutes, but that's sort of best case scenario. So charger anxiety, range anxiety, safety, there's been lots of reports about EV fires. that all goes to lack of confidence. So I think the price and the lack of confidence are really what's standing in the way.
So I think the last observation that I have from doing all of this and talking to the people that we've talked to is about how none of this sort of happens in a vacuum, that the auto industry can't really solve all of its own carbon emissions problems without big help from the outside, whether it's utilities who are still working on greening the grid or consumers who are still deciding whether or not they're on board with, full tilt into electrification, mineral suppliers. It seems to me like a lot of the things that are going to happen in the next 10, 20 years, the industry itself is going to need a lot of help. The government, one that we already mentioned. You know, Hannah, what are your thoughts on sort of the things that might not be in automakers' control here that, are going to be maybe the biggest factors?
Yeah, I think this will be really exciting to watch. I'm excited to cover it. The utility companies have such a big opportunity here. I can't predict exactly how they're going to take advantage of this, if they're going to be kind of the educators for consumers when they buy EVs, how they're going to expand energy to support all these EVs. They could have a really big presence in this, a big public presence in this. And then when it comes to the mineral supply, so when I cover batteries, I'm just like, I wish I was a scientist or a chemist. Like, I just wish I understood this more easily because it's so complicated and there's so many different chemistries to power a battery and so many variations in the minerals and materials that people use to make batteries. So the miners and the mineral companies, there's going to be a lot of fluctuation there. The automakers and battery makers are looking at different types of materials for better energy density and to bring costs down. So there'll be a lot to keep track of. And I mean, once we have a solution that we think is the one, we'll probably have another one around the corner. So it's really all hands on deck and it'll be very cool. I'm excited.
Like Hannah, I'm going to be fascinated to see how it all unfolds. I think what we're seeing right now is the automakers really getting involved in parts of the economy they haven't had to do before. They didn't put gas pumps in your home, but a lot of dealers are being asked to help consumers figure out how to put a charger in their garage. We saw it with Tesla as they tried to create this EV market. And I think we're seeing it from especially General Motors. But I think, some companies are a little more obvious in how they're planning ahead to ensure all the pieces are where they need to be, that there is the mining going on, that there's the refining, that there's recycling that's going to be in the right locations. Now, maybe they invest to get this all up and running and then sell it off and get it back out to other people who are real experts in that field. But they are not leaving it to chance. They're not just waiting and hoping some other industry or the government is going to take care of their problems for them, because, of course, the demand is so huge. And if you're a General Motors or a Toyota or a Volkswagen, it's just you can't let your whole business be left to other people's visions.
Hannah Lutz, Automotive News electrification reporter, and Jamie Butters, Automotive News executive editor. It's been so wonderful to have people much smarter than me along for the ride throughout this entire journey. I really appreciate all of your insights. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Glad to do it, Jake.
Before we put a bow on it, we've talked with dozens of people for this podcast series and asked many of them to talk about the stakes of this transition. We've spoken with environmentalists, industry leaders, analysts, government officials, reporters, tech innovators. None of them have offered an answer that had an impact quite like the person who kicked off this episode, the UNFCCC's Perumal Arumugam. His thoughts on why you, dear listener, should take any action you have the power to take will stick with me for a long time. He started by addressing business leaders directly.
The business profits and benefits can only be achievable if you have a congenial environment in the society to live in. And the effects of climate change can really bring imbalance in terms of climate migration, for example, human migration, which can also be detrimental for the business growth. Every investment that you are doing today, like we talked about $1 billion of investments, if you do not adapt today to the cause and the effect of the climate change, all your investments can be washed away.
But even if you don't quite fall into that category, or if that argument falls short for you, he said there's an even more basic, more existential, more human reason to simply do what you can.
Your mere existence is in question. And then whatever that you are making choices today, every irresponsible way of you emitting today, you are taking away a day from your future generation of your own kith and kin.
This has been Driving to Zero, the auto industry's roadmap to carbon neutrality. Thank you so much for joining me along this ride. I hope it's provided you some insights and shown light on something new for you. If you enjoyed this podcast and want to learn more about the auto industry's ride into a greener future, I highly recommend checking out our daily auto industry news podcast, Daily Drive. That's hosted by Jamie Butters, who you heard on this and every episode of this series, as well as my colleague Kellen Walker. And also check out our weekly podcast, Shift, a podcast about mobility. Host Pete Bigelow talks with some of the people who are leading the way on technology and innovation in the auto industry, and they hit on many of the subjects that we've covered here in even greater detail. And of course, consider subscribing to Automotive News. We're the paper of record for the auto industry, and there you can find incredible reporting from journalists that you've heard here, including Hannah Lutz, Michael Martinez, Lindsay Van Holy, Hans Greimel, and Audrey LaForest. You can find all of their reporting at autonews.com or on the pages of our weekly print edition of Automotive News. All of the original music and sound design that you heard here was done by the incredible, the one and only Sam Bobian. We got additional help along the way from Kellen Walker, Alicia Anderson, Victor Galvan, Tim Reck, Jack Hallauer, Marissa Marcinkowski, and Dean Storm. I'm Jake Neer. Thanks again, and hope to talk soon.